We are doing the Rambam's introduction to mitzvot. In the Rambam Nam edition, it is page Nun Aleph. The Rambam has been explaining to us the different components of the different siddurim, orders of the Mishnah, and we're holding by the order of nizikin, damages. Achar kach, after this, chilek ha-mamar b'nizikin. So then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi arranged the Mishnayot in the order of nizikin. V'chilek ha-masech t'rishona l'shlosha halakim. And he broke down the first tractate into three sections. Traditionally, we view Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Baba Basra, each one has 10 chapters, as 10, really 30 chapters of one major Masechet called Nezikin, that were broken down into 10. So the first Masechet of Nezikin has Baba Kama, the first Kama means earlier, preceding, first. That's Baba Kama. So Rebbe began with Baba Kama. And the focus of Baba Kama is about damages and watching one's objects from damaging. Kigon, for example, shor, one's ox, uvol, or the pit that one digs, vehever, or the fire that one burns, vedina chovel, or the laws of damaging a fellow man physically, vechadomelo, and similar laws. Ben ha-shofet rashai lakdim davar, and the judge may not proceed with anything kodem sheyasir hahezek mibnei adam, before he removes damaging from mankind. Meaning the judge's first responsibility is to remove the things that damage. Umipnei zeh ikdim ota barishona al shar hadinim. And that's why the first thing that Rebbe deals with is preventing damages. What is my responsibility as far as society is concerned to ensure that my objects or my body does not damage others? The hakach, and then the second tractate, the next set of 10 chapters, is Baba Metzia, the middle tractate. V'inyana, and the focus of Baba Metzia is l'deber al ha-ta'anot, to discuss the claims, v'apikdonot u'schirut, and giving things for someone to watch, and the laws of rent, v'dina shoel, and the laws of borrowing, v'asachir, and the laws of someone who's a waged worker, someone who you hire, v'chol ma sheroi l'chaber l'zainyan, and all the things that really fit to be discussed together with this topic. Kmo she'asa katuv, just as the verse has this order. Shachar dinei shor uvol v'hever v'chi natzu anashim, after the laws in Parshas Mishpatim of damages of one's ox, one's pit, one's fire, or two people that are fighting, then diber al arba shomrim, the verse goes on to discuss the four different types of people who can take responsibility of someone else's object. You could watch something for free. You could watch something because you're hired. You could rent something. You could borrow something. And there are different responsibilities depending on the terms of why you have someone else's object. So that's Baba Metzia. B'chakach Baba Batra v'inyano. And then we have the last tractate. And the topics that are covered there is l'daber b'chiluk ha-karkot, to discuss the division of land. V'adinim b'inyan adirot ha-mshutafot v'ashkunot, and the laws about communal living, or the different laws of a community, uvitul mikach umimkar b'mumah nimtza, or laws, we also have the laws of when is a sale annul, when do we consider it that there was a misrepresentation of the facts that the sale was based on, uldaber b'inyan ha-mimkarim ha-kinyanim, and the different laws of sale and acquiring possessions, v'heach ha-oi ladun otam, and how we rule in different cases, v'arevot, and co-signing v'ayirushot, and the laws of inheritance. So all this is covered in Bava Basra. V'sider ha-chelk hazeh ba'achona, and Rebbe ordered this as in the end of the three tractates, v'shvil shekulo kabbalah v'dibrei svarot, v'lo itver min ha-Torah, because this tractate revolves around our tradition and our logic. We don't have any real source in the Torah. All the laws of inheritance and things like that, the Torah doesn't really give us specifications. It primarily revolves around our tradition and our logic. And after, in these three tractates, Rebbe explained the different laws. So the next thing to discuss is the laws of the judges. How do you appoint judges? What the judges' responsibilities are? So after Baba Basra, Rebbe gives us the tractate of Sanhedrin. Aval Masechet Makot, he nikshar et benuschaot im Masechet Sanhedrin. But the tractate of Makos according to some versions, is really chapters of Sanhedrin. Some versions don't have tractate Makos as its own tractate. Ubichlalai minuyan, and really some enumerate Makos as part of Sanhedrin. Ve'amvu, and our sages explain, shebishvil she'amar, that being that Rebbe says in the Mishnah, there's a chapter at the end of Sanhedrin that says, ve'elu en anechnachin, these are the people that get the death penalty of strangulation. So then Rebbe went on to enumerate in the tractate of Makos, the first chapter, not the first chapter, but it says, Elu ein alokin. These are those that get lashes. So the Rambam says, those who give this reason, that the reason why the tractates are ordered like this is because there's a similarity. These are those that get strangulations. These are those that get makos. That's not true, says the Rambam. Doesn't say that in Chazal. So says the Rambam. Where are we? Avali masech bifnetzma. In truth, says the Rambam, makos is its own tractate. Those who want to say that makos is really a part of Sanhedrin, that's not true. They're making a mistake. Really, Makos is its own tractate. V'nismicha l'sanhedrin mitnei she'en rashut l'bnei adam l'anosh u'l'alkot ela l'shoftim atzmam. And the reason it's aligned with Sanhedrin is to tell us that the average person is not allowed to punish someone else. He's not allowed to beat up someone else. That's the judge's responsibility. Kmo she'amar ha'katuv, as the verse says, v'yipilo ha'shofet, the judge can throw him down v'yikau l'fanav k'dei rishato, and then have him beaten the way he deserves, according to his wickedness. And following tractate Makos, Rebbe organized the tractate of Shavuos, because there are similarities between the concluding topic of Makos, which discusses the laws of shaving and how one can shave and transgress. On the face we have corners, so in one shaving you can transgress a certain number. And the enumeration of the prohibitions is similar to the enumeration of the prohibited vows. So, being that there are similarities in the semantics of the end of the tractate of Makos to the beginning of tractate Shavuos, so therefore they were aligned. And there's also similarity between their laws. And there are similarities in their laws, umishpeteim. And they're similar to one another. As the Talmud mentions. That's interesting because I said it's semantics. The Rambam seems to say it's more, really, there are legal similarities. I don't know how the Rambam means. And really, it's over there because it's really one of the things the judges do. They make people take vows. Only the judge can force one to take a vow. And now that Rebbe concluded discussing the judges and the laws and everything that's unique to the judges, for example, lashes and obligating taking vows, so then Rebbe gives us the tractate of Eduyot. What is the tractate of Eduyot? Who knows? Eduyot is a tractate. V'rov inyan zot ha'masechet hu. And the primary focus of this tractate is lizkor ba kol ha'alachot, to mention all the laws she'he'idu aleihem anashim brurim ne'emanim, that trustworthy people gave testimony to those laws, v'she'edutam ruya lismoch aleihem, that we can rely on their testimony. So the Rambam over here is really skipping a point. Our sages say that on the day that Rabban Gamliel was removed from being the Nasi, so they opened the doors of the Beis HaMedrash, and many, many new students came in, and these students brought with them certain traditions that they didn't have in the Beis HaMedrash. They brought with them testimony. So sometimes they had certain questions which they couldn't verify what the tradition was, and the question was left hanging in the Beis HaMedrash. And on this day that they had open door policy, that anyone could come in, or in this period when they had open door policy, so then there were all kinds of testimonies given. I have a tradition such and such, and they verified, and it was worthy testimony. So they put together all these unique testimonies, they put them in this tractate of Eduyot. The Rambam doesn't mention that. The Gemara in Brachos says this. The Rambam doesn't say this. The Rambam just says these are testimonies of people that are trustworthy, that we can rely on. The Hushal min adinim, and this is, so to speak, the fact that witnesses can give testimony is one of the keys, one of the gates to having a justice system, to giving laws. Testimony must be given before judges. So that's why it's connected to this tractate. All testimony was given before the court. And the order of Eduyot is to follow Shvuot. Because Shvuot is necessary on a permanent basis. And Eduyot refers to testimony, that specific testimony that was given at specific times and was accepted before the judges. So we're almost finished with the order of Nezikin. The Rambam says, and then the Rebbe started explaining the tractate of Avodah Zarah, because the topic of Avodah Zarah is something that's imperative upon the judge to know. And only then is the judge considered whole. This is a very interesting point. Every judge had to study the different laws and customs of idol worship. And only then could he be a complete judge. One of his responsibilities is to know how do you serve the different idols and what's necessary for the service of that idol. Only then can you judge regarding questions of idol worship. If a guy stood before an idol and started doing this, okay, is that idol worship? I don't know. But maybe if I learned and studied this idol worship, I'll know that that's the way you worship this idol. So the judges, one of the things they had to know was how were the idols worshipped. And we could see a very strong example of that that occurred recently. There's a custom in India and other Buddhist countries that people grow their hair long and they come to the temple and they shave their head, and then they some of that hair is offered as sacrifice before the idol. The priests have a multi-million-dollar industry, a billion-dollar industry. They take that hair and they make wigs out of it and they sell it. An average wig can sell for $500, $700. Figure they have 100 clients a day. So you're talking about $50,000 a day. It's a big industry. The question is, can we Jews use that hair? Do we consider it that hair was offered as a sacrifice to the idols? Or no, part of their preparation for the idol worship is shaving their head, and then they take part of that hair and that's what's sacrificed, but the rest of the hair is permitted to be used. That is unclear. That's a major question that arose a few years ago. Truth is, this question arose more than a few years ago. It resurfaced a few years ago. And because of this question, rabbis said women shouldn't wear a wig from those places unless they could verify that their wig was not from those places. Now, in essence, we need to know how this idol is worshipped. Is this part of the idol worshipping or not? Today you'll go there, they've all been trained to tell you, no, it's not. They know that they're risking their billion-dollar industry if they tell you. Now, in these huge mosques, they have hundreds if not thousands of people walking in a day. So you figure, each priest over there is making about $50,000 a day off the hair of these little peasants. I mean, they have people who barely have bread to eat, but they believe in this, they come in, they shave their head. The priests are very, very rich, but the peasants, they don't know anything about this. They don't know that their hair is being sold. So you have to know, how is this idol being worshipped? What does the peasant think when he's shaving his head? Does he view it that he's serving the idol and shaving his head or not? Is that a form of idol worship for him? The priest is going to tell you, no, we're not worshiping the idol in that. Because he knows if he admits that they are, then he's just lost a huge part of the industry. Who buys wigs? Jewish women. Who are they selling to? So the rabbis tried verifying this, but they hadn't verified it beforehand. And to try and verify it today, well, today they all know the right answers. So here we see an example of what the Rambam said. To be a complete judge, they had to know all the nuances of idol worship as well. So that's why the Rambam says, Rebbe ordered the tractate of Avodah Zarah over here. Kichol mishi avod lechochav shabtai b'avodat kochav noga. For example, says the Rambam, anyone that worships the Mercury with the service of Venus, I think Shabtai and Noga is Mercury and Venus, but I don't remember. It's two of the stars in the solar system. If you worship this star with the service that's really fitting the other star, so then, O yitpalel lechochav tzedek b'tfilat ma'adim, no, ma'adim is Mercury. Or he'll pray to one star with the prayer that's really fitting for another star. He doesn't get the death penalty. That's our tradition. That there are four acts that if you do them before any idol, you get the death penalty. Bowing, slaughtering. There are four acts that the Gemara enumerates that's universal for all idols. Any other act, it depends on, is that part of the specific worship of that idol? So if you start worshipping one idol with another idol's form of worship, that's not considered idol worship. You don't get the death penalty. Markulis, the way of worshipping it was you throw a rock at it. That's how they worshipped it. It was like they'd stack a few rocks, throw a rock at them and knock them down. That was the form of idol worship. Now if you throw a rock at Buddha, you haven't done idol worship. That's not the way you worship Buddha. So our sages had to know what was the exact form of idol worship for each idol. And Rebbe left this for last, because it doesn't happen that you find an issue with idol worship. It's one in a thousand and it's infrequent. So Rebbe left this tractate for last because you don't have to worry about it so much. And once Rebbe finished all the things that a judge needs to know, he began the tractate of Avos. And the reason Rebbe did this was for two reasons. Ha'echad, firstly, kedei lo'odia she'askama va'kabbalah, in order to make known that the agreement between rabbis, the way the rabbis instituted halacha and their tradition, emet unchona, is true, is really correct. V'kiblua am me'am, and the masses have a tradition from the masses that preceded them. The tradition we have has gone from generation to generation. And therefore, when we read Pirkei Avos, and we begin Pirkei Avos, and we see the tradition, and we understand the ordering of how the oral law was passed down from one generation of rabbis to another generations of rabbis, so then, when we look back at the rabbis, we say, oh, I really should respect him. And to place him in the proper elevated position he should be, because he has the true tradition. His position in his generation is like these rabbis' position in their generation. And that's what our sages said. If we want to come and try to question Rabbi Gamliel's court, then we have to try and figure out, do we accept any court from the time of Moshe till now? This was a story where Rabbi Gamliel ruled that it's a new month. And when you looked at the sky, it didn't make sense as ruling. The next night looked like it was the night of the new moon. So Rabbi Gamliel ruled it should be a new month. And Rabbi Yeshua said, how could you do that? What was the problem? The problem was that it was the month of Tishrei. And the difference between whether Rosh Chodesh was today or tomorrow was the difference between his Yom Kippur on one day or the next day. Rabbi Yeshua said, I don't understand how Rabbi Gamliel ruled that this day should be Rosh Chodesh. I can't keep Yom Kippur 10 days from his Rosh Chodesh. That's what Rabbi Yeshua said. And he met up with his disciple Rabbi Akiva, who said to him, the verse, when it enumerates the elders on Moshe's court, it doesn't enumerate who they were. It tells us in general terms, the elders. Why doesn't the verse tell us their names? They were great sages. The verse is teaching us a rule. Once you have a court, you don't look into the details who's on that court. You have the high court of the Jewish people. The way they rule, you have to go with it. You don't start questioning, well, was he on the level or was he on the level? Right now, the head of the court is Rabbi Gamliel. We have a tradition that if he's the head of the court and he ruled that this is the day the new month begins, that's the day it begins. Like it, good. You don't like it, your problem. But you have to accept it. And when Rabbi Akiva told him that, so he accepted it. Rabbi Gamliel ordered Rabbi Yeshua. He said, on the day that you hold this Yom Kippur, I want you to come before me with your stick and your money belt to show everyone that you're not keeping Yom Kippur on this day. You won't carry your stick in public domain. You won't carry your money belt on Yom Kippur. When you do this, everyone will recognize that there's one day of Yom Kippur, and you conceded to what I said. And when Rabbi Yeshua, the elder, came before Rabbi Gamliel, the young Nasi, Rabbi Gamliel got up and kissed him, and he said, Shalom Alecha, Rebbe v'talmidi. Welcome, my Rebbe and my disciple. You are my Rebbe because you know more than me. And you're smarter than me, but you're my Talmud because you accepted my ruling. Why then did Rabbi Gamliel rule differently than Rabbi Yeshua? If he's conceding that Rabbi Yeshua is the greater sage, why did he rule differently? Because he had a tradition that only the house of the Nasi had, and that was a tradition about how we calculate the new moon. And with that tradition, he said, I have to rule this way. Rabbi Yeshua did not have that tradition. So Rabbi Yeshua, using his own logic, reached a different conclusion. So now, Rabbi Gamliel said, I have to rule this way. This is the tradition I have. And you, Rabbi Yeshua, have to accept it. You don't understand it, so you have a problem. But the ruling you have to accept. So the rule that the Rambam's quoting from here is that we don't ask questions about who was on the court. And that's the concept of the beginning of Pirkei Avos, that we see the tradition, and once we see the tradition, we say, okay, if he's the one in the position of leadership today, we follow him. There was a big sefer written on the laws of different Yamim Tovim, and the one who authored the sefer interviewed many Rabbanim. And in his interview, so he'd asked them all kinds of different detailed questions about the laws of the Yom Tov that are relevant today. And the rabbis would sometimes tell him, here the halachas like this, here the halachas like that. And he's writing this all down. And then he'd come back to them a second time and he'd say, look, I spoke to Rav Yashiv, and he holds on this question like that, different than you said. And many a time, the rabbis very often would tell him, well, if that's what he said, so write what he said. So he'd say, but you hold differently. So they'd say, yeah, but he's the posek of Am Yisrael today. If he's paskening like this, then Am Yisrael has to know the halacha is like this. So then the rabbi who was writing the book would ask them, but you hold differently. So they'd say, yeah, but it's not worth making a machlokas. If he says like this, we go like that. And sometimes they'd say, okay, you could write in the footnote, and there is an opinion, there is a Rav who holds not like that. If you want, you could write, sometimes they let him write as a footnote, and sometimes not. Why? This concept, that when there is a leadership, we go with the leadership. When there was a question about rain death, so Rav Feinstein paskened one way. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wanted to argue with him. He wrote a whole response arguing with him, and sent it to Rabbi Feinstein and asked him for permission, can I publish it? Why? He said, I'm not going to argue with you unless you agree that I'm allowed to argue with you. I think differently learning the sugiyah, but I want you to read my response and tell me if it's okay to publish it. Rav Shlomo Zalman conceded that Rav Moshe was the posik of the generation. I think that's the way I understand the story. Yeah? Because they didn't know, they didn't always say, well, omit my opinion. Sometimes they said, leave my opinion as a footnote. So then someone who's learning the Sefer can see that there's another opinion. So the first point the Rambam says, the idea of Pirkei Avos is to explain to us the tradition. And once we have that tradition, we understand that the view we're supposed to have of the rabbis and the courts that are leading the generation, this stems from the fact that we see the tradition, and they're the continuation of the tradition. The Amrun, our sages, taught us a rule, Shimshon bedoro k'Shmuel bedoro. Samson in his generation was like Shmuel, the greatest leader, in his generation. Whoever is the leader, we give him respect, even though sometimes we'll say he's not as great as his predecessors, nonetheless, he's the leader. Uvinyan ze yesh musar gadol livnei adam. And regarding this, as the Rambam, there's a very important message for mankind. Shelo yomru, people shouldn't say, Madua nekaben mishpat ploni. Why should we accept the ruling of so-and-so? O takanat dayan ploni, or the institution of so-and-so, the judge. Ve'en adavar ken, that's wrong, says the Rambam. Shamishpat eino lifloni ashofet. It's not that we view it as though so-and-so, the judge, he gave this ruling. Ela la'kadosh baruch hu, shetziva otanu bo. But rather, we view it that God gave this judgment, and God commanded us to listen to the judge. As the verse says, Ki hamishpat le'elokim hu. God says, I'm the one giving the ruling. Aval hakol mishpat echad, and rather we say all of it is really one judgment, one ruling, the kiblu ish mi pi ish ala dorot acholfim, and their ruling stems from the tradition that they have generation after generation. So that's the first idea of Pirkei Avos, that after we've learned about the rules of the Sanhedrin and all things they're supposed to know, Rebbe was pointing out to us that the Sanhedrin is part of this continuum, they're part of the tradition, and that's the way we should view them. So that was the first point. Ba'inyan ha-sheni, in the second point of the tractate of Avos, Shu rotzeh lizkor masechet zu, Rebbe wants to mention in this masechet, Musar kol chacham min ha-chachamim, aleihem ha-shalom. The teachings of correct behavior that the different sages taught us, may they rest in peace, so that we learn from them what are good traits. And the one who needs this most is no one who needs it as much as the judges. The judges need it more than anyone else to know what's the correct way to behave. Because the common folk, when they don't behave in a moral fashion, so then they're not damaging everyone. If the average person does something wrong, his damage is minimal. He's only damaging the person himself. But a judge, when he is immoral, when he is not modest, he not only damages himself, but he's also damaging mankind. That's why Rebbe begins the tractate of Avos with rebuke for the judges. What does he say? He's giving instructions to the judges. The very first Mishnah says, take it easy, don't give ruling too fast. Be slow to give ruling. And the judge's responsibility is to take to heart, to learn it from all the messages of the tractate of Avot. Kigon sheyeh matun badin vani meher psakdin. For example, he should be slow in giving judgment. He shouldn't be quick to give judgment.